Miami will host the final presidential debate, a debate over historic monuments in Florida, and a conversation about happiness. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. First, we're going to look at an incident in North Central Florida in the retirement community of The Villages. It was between Trump supporters and protesters captured on video and later posted on Twitter. Someone yelled white power. Trump retweeted it, thanking the supporters in the community. We'll dig into that story and the presidential debate scheduled for the Arsht in October. Also, monuments around the world are coming down. We're going to look at the debate over monuments to Florida's past and how we should recognize them. And finally, a recent study shows Americans are the unhappiest they've been in 50 years. We'll discuss the economics of happiness and how to find joy in these challenging times. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. A two-minute video posted on Twitter from The Villages, that's a large retirement community in Central Florida, has further fueled the conversation around racism in our politics. In the video, there's a caravan of golf carts driven by Trump supporters. And then there's a confrontation between the supporters and a group of protesters. And you can hear protesters calling the Trump supporters racist and asking, quote, "Where's your white hood?" And then you hear one Trump supporter say, quote, "White power, white power." Early Sunday morning, President Trump retweeted the video with a comment, quote, "Thank you to the great people of The Villages. The radical left do-nothing Democrats will fall in the fall. Corrupt Joe is shot. See you soon," end quote. Well, the tweet was deleted 3 hours later, and a spokesperson for the president said he did not hear the white power comments. Now, this comes as Black Lives Matter protests continue across the country. Joining us now to talk about this story is the Miami Herald's David Smiley. David, always great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So the video is from, again, an event in The Villages. This was June 14th on the president's birthday. What was happening at The Villages that day?
Well, there was a golf cart caravan organized by Trump's supporters in The Villages, which is a very heavily conservative retirement community in Central Florida. And his supporters were driving in a line through one of these town squares. There are multiple town squares in The Villages. And in this one particular gathering of shops and streets in Sumter County, his supporters were driving and they were passing by critics of the president, supporters of his Democratic opponent, Joe Biden, and they were clashing and yelling things at each other. Neither side was being particularly cordial to the other, but obviously this one exchange involving a driver of a golf cart who shouted white power in response to someone asking him where his white hood was at the very beginning of this video clip that the president tweeted.
And as you said, this is a large conservative community, but also kind of important for candidates who want to win the I-4 corridor, right?
Right. I mean, the president, people in The Villages have given themselves credit for helping the president win Florida in 2016 and for helping Governor Ron DeSantis win a very narrowly decided election for governor in 2018 over Andrew Gillum. It's it is a place where Republicans want to run up the score. It is almost entirely conservative, almost entirely white. And Trump recently visited, I think about a year ago, to The Villages when he was just being impeached, to kind of, you know, bask in the warmth of tried and true supporters. The Villages is very much Donald Trump territory.
So the Miami Herald spoke with the Twitter user that posted this video. How did he describe the confrontation?
Well, the user wasn't there to record it. And I corresponded with this person through direct message. Didn't want to call me, but responded to my questions through Twitter and explained that this user, I'm not sure if it's male or female, but explained that they had grabbed the content from a news service, which had actually posted it, a news service from The Villages, which had actually posted the footage on its YouTube account. So this person just took some of that footage and cut it together. And so this exchange had been previously out there for about 2 weeks before it captured the president's attention.
So, what has the White House said about the fact that the president retweeted it and then removed it?
Well, they say he didn't see the white power exchange, which is possible. Although I will say that when I watched the video the first time, I didn't have the sound on. And I noticed just by watching the man's fist being raised and looking at his lips, I could see that he yelled white power before I went and listened to it to confirm that he did actually say that. So it was really hard to miss. I mean, he does this 8 seconds into the video clip, but the White House is saying that the president did not see him yell this, but they don't address, or they did not, to us, they did not address why he deleted the video or whether he condemned, the phrase white power.
And of course, I mean, this is all happening as we have the Black Lives Matter movement going on across the country. I mean, how does this play into the protests that are going on?
Well, I'll address politically first that the president clearly believes that his campaign can win over more black voters than they did in 2016. They've been campaigning to black voters with an economic message and arguing that Democrats have done nothing to support the black community, that Democrats are all talk, no action. So certainly it would only stand to hurt those efforts for the president. And then for the protests, I mean, if anything, that's just throwing gasoline on a fire that's still raging across the country, from people, not just black Americans, but brown Americans, white Americans, people from all demographics, and ages who are coming out to support protests against social injustices embedded in the country. I don't know if it was mentioned much in Miami during the protest this weekend, which seemed to be focused, interestingly, on Latin America, but it certainly can only prove incendiary to those efforts.
I'm talking with David Smiley, senior political reporter for the Miami Herald. You could read David's latest stories. Go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. So, David, in the past couple of weeks, we've learned that President Trump is going to be in Florida for two major events, a debate with presumed Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. That's going to be in Miami, and the Republican National Convention in Jacksonville. How did the Arch Center, the site of the Democratic presidential debates a year ago, land the final debate?
That's a good question. I have asked the commission that organizes the presidential debates, and they have not responded to those questions about why they chose the Arched. So I don't know the backstory as to how that happened. It is interesting that they would. The event is moving to Miami because previously it was scheduled at the University of Michigan, and the university's leadership consulted with some health experts and decided that it was a bad idea due to the coronavirus outbreak for them to host what in this case is supposed to be a town hall style debate, in which an audience that is present for the event is asking questions of the candidates. And so the idea that this event would be moved to South Florida, which is the epicenter of the state of Florida's coronavirus outbreak, is something of a curious call. But no one has answered my questions about the how to this point.
Yeah, I mean, wondering, like, because as you said, this is the final debate before the general election. This is the more intimate setting where the president and the other candidate are moving around and talking to the folks in the audience as they ask these questions. Is the Arch Center still going to be doing that? Is still running it that way, or do they have a plan on how to keep people social distance?
I wouldn't bank on knowing what they're going to do, or at least expecting any idea of a full audience at this point. Right now, what we do know is that the Arched, which remains closed, it's county owned, it remains closed due to the pandemic in South Florida, that the Arched, the nonprofit that leads the Performing Arts Center, has submitted a plan to the county to allow it to reopen. And that plan would dramatically reduce capacity in its two performance halls, and would also require masks be worn indoors. So we know at least what the reopening would, what the nonprofit would hope it will look like for going to performances, but what it might look like for a presidential debate, or whether they would actually even be able to have a crowd there to ask questions of the presidential candidates, remains unclear.
And moving over to the other big event, the one in Jacksonville, the RNC, excuse me, the convention. RNC officials have a really tough task trying to get this convention ready in last minute. What have we heard about safety precautions to prevent the spread of the virus there?
Well, just today, on Monday, the city's leadership announced that they are ordering a masks indoors requirement for anybody in situations where social distancing cannot be observed. We don't know how long that will last, so we don't know if that's going to extend through the convention. But right now, for the convention itself, all of the statements we've heard from the mayor of Jacksonville or the governor of Florida is that they want to wait until closer to the event when there is a better outlook of, or when we will know more specifically what the outlook of the pandemic is around the time of the late August convention, so that they can make a decision on whether to require masks or whether to space out seats and things like that. Talking to health experts, I've been told that it's very unlikely that the pandemic will be reduced in severity enough by late August that the Republican National Committee can have a full arena as they'd like to have. But there's a sort of cross your fingers and wait and see from the Republican leadership in the state right now.
And as you said, Jacksonville now putting on this new mandatory of wearing a mask, but DeSantis has not done that for the state of Florida. And we've seen the president at rallies tell his supporters, don't wear masks. So, I mean, has the city or the RNC said anything about how they're going to handle that?
No, we have reached out to the RNC today to see if they'll discuss the latest with the convention, and we have not yet heard back. So I don't know what the reaction is yet to the mask order. But again, we don't know if it will still be in place. And so far, the RNC has really resisted any efforts to get them they get the organization to nail down any kind of health precautions when the governor of North Carolina asked the RNC to do that back when the convention was still expected to go on in full in the city of Charlotte. The RNC really would not put specific plans. They sent a letter with some vague intentions to the governor, but ultimately pulled out, saying that they needed a commitment from the state that they would be able to have a full-fledged convention. And so even one thing that we should mention, though, is that Florida has not actually given that commitment. We have not yet heard Governor Ron DeSantis, at least publicly, say that he would guarantee a full-fledged convention. If anything, he said, the governor said yesterday that he's still in a sort of wait and see and hope to hold it as the RNC would like.
And that's an interesting point. I mean, what I wondered what you heard from the public health experts about, again, their concern about having a convention. You have thousands of people in a space, people from out of state as well. And if you don't have the social distancing or at least wearing of the masks, has there been a conversation of whether from Governor DeSantis or Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry about, well, maybe we might have to just cancel it if we can't offer you a full house and well, we can't do it.
The governor's position on that is Florida should have a default of we are going to get to the type of gathering that the RNC would want. But what we're hearing from the mayor of Jacksonville is more of public safety comes first, that if the pandemic does not allow for a full-fledged convention, that for the city of Jacksonville, that they are not going to endanger people in order to host a packed arena. And so certainly, I think both the mayor, Lenny Curry in Jacksonville, and Governor Ron DeSantis want to make this happen. We're hearing hedging from them that they're not going to have this event at the cost of people getting sick. One thing we have heard out of Jacksonville and the governor is that the city of Jacksonville's pandemic is comparatively minor if you look at, for instance, South Florida. But the other that's really only a part of the picture. If you look at the whole extent of the convention, the broader concern is you have people from all over the country potentially mingling for prolonged periods in a confined space and then leaving and going back to their communities. So even if Jacksonville's outbreak is relatively minor at the time of the convention, there's the potential that people coming in could actually cause an outbreak to seed in the city of Jacksonville or cause it to spread in dozens of communities outside of Florida. So it's not really just about
Yeah.
what do Jacksonville's numbers look like.
It's a convention. You've got people coming in from all over the country. David Smiley, senior political reporter for the Miami Herald. You could read his latest stories. Go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. David, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Lewis.
Well, still to come, a look at our history and monuments and the question, should monuments be taken down? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Statues and monuments linked to slavery are being taken down, sometimes forcefully by protesters themselves all across the country. People are grappling with monuments and street names that memorialize a painful history. Earlier this month, protesters turned to vandalize the statues of Spanish conquistadors Christopher Columbus and Juan Ponce de Leon at Bayside Marketplace in Miami, bringing to the forefront a debate about what these statues signify and where they belong. So we've assembled a panel to discuss this topic. Joining me now, Dr. Andrea Quili. She's an associate professor at Florida International University, teaching anthropology in African and African diaspora studies. Dr. Quili, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is from FIU is Dr. Dan Royals, an assistant professor of United States and African American history. Dr. Royals, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Paul George joins us as well, a resident historian at History Miami Museum. Dr. George, I appreciate the time today.
Thanks so much. It's good to be here.
I wanted to get one general question out to all of you. Just briefly, I wanted your thoughts about statues and monuments, and what's the role that they actually play in our society? Dr. Quili, let me start with you.
So this is, of course, a fantastic question because it really gets at this the heart of the question of history, right? And how it is that we understand history and the making of history and who it is and that we consider deserving of being memorialized publicly, in particular with regards to the monuments. So in history, you know, as Michel Rauf-Trouillot is an anthropologist, Haitian anthropologist, who said that, you know, history is what's happened and what's said to have happened, right? And so there's a kind of privileging of particular narratives. And I think that we see that in the landscape, right? We see that in the choices around which people, which individuals, historical figures get memorialized and why.
Yeah. Dr. Royals, I mean, same question to you, but I mean, I think about what's the role of a statue or monument considering a nation's going to change over time?
I want to build on what Dr. Quili said, and it's that statues and monuments build particular understandings of the past into our everyday landscapes. And they do that in a way that conceals or subsumes the particular histories and power relationships that are behind them. So we see this, for example, with the Confederate statues and monuments that are being, you know, have been and are being now hotly contested, because those statues and monuments build a kind of naturalized understanding of the histories that they represent, into our everyday landscape. They make those things seem everyday, make them seem neutral, make them, divorce them from historical context. And so what we really need is a more critical, contextualized understanding of the past, beyond what statues and monuments often can provide.
Yeah. Dr. George, how about you? I mean, why do we need statues and monuments? What's the role?
Well, they really speak to whoever's depicted in a statue or monument. Speaks to what that person represented in terms of both ideas and action at the time that she or he was on the planet. The problem that we've long had, and I think that some of our other panelists have mentioned too, is that there's just not enough context with the statue. I mean, to look at a statue, and I love that phrase, everyday landscape. I think it's so appropriate because the statue literally and figuratively rises above it. But to look at a person on the part of, just say, an average onlooker in a park or in a public plaza or a square or something, may not really obviously have a deep understanding and idea of that person's role in history at that time. The person, of course, was on the planet. I've always thought that we need more context. That can come to some degree, maybe a limited degree, with historical markers. But I think an ideal place, I'm not saying move every statue into a museum, but an ideal place really to understand historical context would be in a museum where, you have the ability to really kind of lay out the story, probably all facets of the story, about who's ever being depicted on a monument or a statue. But again,
beyond having just a plaque that gives you a little bit of history, there's a lot of history, as I'm hearing from all of you. There's just a lot that you have to understand about that person. Let me move forward here on this conversation about what we have in South Florida. Not a lot of Confederate statues. We do have street names and city names with a Confederate past, but we do have Spanish and European conquerors and explorers. Again, Ponce de Leon and Christopher Columbus. Now they're being attacked. Dr. George, how did we end up with statues of Ponce de Leon and Columbus here? What the role they played in our community?
Well, it's a terrific question. And we ended up that way because Columbus's landing site was within 50 to 80 or 100 miles where we are right now. B, Juan Ponce de Leon may have touched down at Key Biscayne in 1513, by then late spring, but most of his contact was actually around the southwest coast of Florida, where he remained for a while and got to know some of the Native Americans there, the Colusas. But the reason they're there, in addition to the fact that there's this connection with Florida, real tangential in the case of Columbus, a little more closely associated, of course, on the part of Juan Ponce, is because Miami had began to position itself as a gateway to the Americas, at least as far back as the 30s. And you can make a case when William Jennings Bryan, about 1916, he was probably our leading citizen since he was so prominent, talked about a future university from Miami. And the names thrown around at that point was Pan American University. Out of that, of course, grew the idea and the reality of the University of Miami. But what happened in subsequent decades, and again, leaning toward this idea of a gateway to the Americas, a nexus between the Americas, we began to really talk about that. We're going to build a big convention center in the DuPont Plaza neighborhood that would be a Pan-American center. We began to put busts of Latin American and Caribbean leaders on little pedestals in Bayfront Park. The Columbus statue was dedicated on Columbus Day, 1953. Juan Ponce came somewhere in that time. And again, it was positioning ourselves. That's why Juan Ponce is, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, well, all right. So, I mean, again, a lot of history. I apologize. I'm going to cut in from time to time. There's a lot of history here. So that, I mean, again, these are two men who played a big part in the Caribbean history and in Southeast United States history. But Dr. Quealy, I wonder the connection people here have to these two men compared to what you see with people's connection with the Confederacy. I mean, are the people of the Caribbean as connected to Columbus and Ponce de Leon?
That's a wonderful question. So what comes up, I think, in this conversation, one of the things that we have to understand, again, is that Ponce de Leon, Columbus, they exist and have existed within the context of the hypervalorization of the conquistadores, right? And so we know their names, right? But do we know the names of all the indigenous people who, you know, were whose land upon which we stand, right? And this kind of question of what the connection is that people have to them, I think you have to look at it through that lens. So there's a people who have been taught to valorize Europeans, to valorize their European, their Spanish ancestry over their indigenous and African ancestry oftentimes. And so having that connection is not neutral. I think my colleague Dan Royals was saying that there's a kind of lack of neutrality, right? Or a guise of neutrality when it's really not neutral because it exists within the context of European conquest, colonization, and white supremacy.
So it just seems like it's still more about education. Again, not the monuments, it's just the education. Because again, so much context, so much history. Dr. Mm-hmm. Royals, I mean, I'm curious too about, you know, again, we hear the debate about getting rid of the Confederate monuments and statues because of that link to our racist past. There is a dark side to the past for the conquistadors. But people will argue, well, you know, that doesn't link to the history of racism today. What do you think about that part of the debate?
I mean, a couple of things that I want to say here. One is that we're talking about the memorialization of conquistadores and Confederate monuments as though they are two separate but maybe tangentially related issues. And I think that they're not. So going back to the example of Columbus, the history of the celebration of, you know, the Columbus story or really the Columbus myth in the United States is connected in important ways to the way that in the late 19th century, new immigrants, so Italians, Irish, were able to lay claim to whiteness because when they arrived in the United States, you know, they were considered kind of off-white or liminally white, or, you know, somewhere between black and white. And the celebration of the Columbus story and the Columbus myth was really part and parcel of the way that they wrote themselves into a white supremacist national history. At the same time that groups like the United Daughters of the Confederacy were promulgating a false narrative about the causes of the Civil War. We're promulgating what we call the lost cause myth of Civil War history. This is the idea, a very romantic idea about the Confederacy, what the antebellum South was. This is the kind of Moonlight and Magnolias, you know, benevolent slave master vision.
And you know what, but Dr. Royals, that's it. You said something interesting there is the romanticization of our past. Have we done that with people like Ponce de Leon and Columbus?
Absolutely. There's no question about that. Yeah. But so I also want to just push back on one thing in particular, and that is the idea that, you know, we are somehow outside of that Confederate memorialization. We see maybe less evidence of that in Miami, although we do have Dixie Highway running through, Miami.
We have roads. You're right. No, we have a number of, it's not, it, I just want to say like, it, it's not compared to as I've traveled through places like Louisiana or, you know, South North Carolina, places like that. It's very different, but we've been hearing from listeners, by the way, on this topic on Twitter, Sam Thiepen Bermeo tweeted out to us this: Columbus enslaved so many Native Americans by 1499 that Queen Isabella exploded at him saying, "Who is this Columbus who dares to give out my vassals as slaves?" This mass dehumanization, even unlawful at the time, still matters today. By the way, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. We'd like to hear your thoughts on this. Dr. Queeley, what is the history behind what he's saying about the Spanish monarchy criticizing the slavery?
So actually, it's interesting because I'm not familiar with that particular criticism, right? But this gets back to the point, you know, it gets back to what it is that I think both Dan and I were saying, which is that there's a process that has happened, which has kind of siloed you know, Spanish history from, you know, English history, you know, the various European powers and the ways in which history is taught is that, oh, that's something that's separate, right? So, you know, this kind of conquering or what is said as the discovery, right, of the quote unquote New World is separate from the enslavement of Africans, right? That's what you're taught. But as you're the Twitter person, the person who tweeted pointed out that actually they're very, you know, they're absolutely worked in conjunction with one another, right? So the conversation about enslavement must also include indigenous people.
People will talk about their heritage and their link to their heritage when they talk about the South. I'm wondering, Dr. George, with the Hispanic communities, the Latino communities here in South Florida, what is their link to, you know, to Columbus, to Ponce de Leon? How do they view these people? Is it something you could say that really they look at them differently than perhaps white Americans do?
Well, you know, I don't think there's a strong attachment at this time to either of them. And I think in a general sense, that is the way it is across the United States. Let me just offer one thing. I was doing some research on another topic the other day, and Miami Herald 1955, Mayor Abramovitz on Columbus Day asked every Miamian to take several moments of silence and think about the great contributions Christopher Columbus made to the New World. And you can imagine today what that would be like. We had a huge Chicago white city in 1893 centered around the 400th anniversary of Columbus. In 1992, at best, the celebrations were muted. Hardly anything was going on. So I think that he has really escaped, in terms of a positive force, our imaginations and our memories today. Juan Ponce would be much more of a regional figure, and it really speaks to Florida. But I just don't think it's either one is a topic that comes up much in Spanish-speaking or Hispanic communities in greater Miami or Florida. It's something that time has kind of passed by. But then again, I think so many statues of people are experiencing that too in the society we live in, except now we're in a certain urgency maybe to kind of reevaluate these things and decide to do something about them.
Again, we are talking about statues and monuments. Now, a lot of the debate we're hearing is about Confederate statues and monuments, but there's been conversation about people like Christopher Columbus or Ponce de Leon. Should we have these statues and monuments up, or do we need them in museums? Again, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter, WLRN Sundial. Let us know what you think. Again, I'm talking with a panel of historians, Dr. Andrea Quigley, an associate professor at Florida International University, Dr. Dan Royals, an assistant professor of United States and African American History, and Dr. Paul George, a resident historian at History Miami Museum. Dr. Quigley, where do we go from here when it comes to these particular, these monuments? When you talk about Columbus and Ponce de Leon or other conquistadors, you know, earlier American history, what should we do with them?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a great question. I'm actually not a historian, by the way. I'm an anthropologist.
Thank you. Sorry. Thank you for the correction.
Okay. But I, you know, I've thought about this question. What is the kind of society that I would envision that I would want to live in? What would they do, right, with these statues, with these monuments? And so one of the obvious answers to that question is, of course, having, you know, putting them in museums, right, so they can actually be used as tools for education. I also thought about having, because I believe that this is a part of, and I'm hoping that we're on the brink of some kind of process of truth and reconciliation nationally, and wondering whether or not an actual burial, right, of these statues would be appropriate. Having some kind of symbolic ritual that would kind of signal that we are embarking upon a new chapter within this country, right? So I think that there are different possibilities, right? And I think that we have to kind of, as a society, decide who it is that we want to be, right? How is it that we might want to honor the actual tenets that this, you know, this country, the United States, is supposed to be about?
Let me push back on you a little bit on that. I'm wondering, have you seen that happen somewhere else where they did that to their statues and monuments?
No. So maybe we would be the first. There are different countries that have had truth and reconciliation commissions. And so maybe there is some record of, you know, ideas or processes that they've gone through to deal with the physical kind of remnants of their past. Right, and reckoning with their past.
Dr. George, what about you? I mean, what should happen to these monuments? And I wonder, like, you think about other countries, where they look at their pass and maybe don't want at least that, you know, that pass to be out in the open because it maybe it's kind of dark.
Right. Well, you know, there's been so many different approaches to this, so many different actions. Some have been destroyed. Others have been vandalized. Others have been subject to demands. Let's get them out of here. Teddy Roosevelt mounted on a horse above a Native American and an African American. Apparently going to be moved back into the Museum of Natural History in New York City. So there's so many different looks. But as somebody who represents history in Miami, I just think it's important that, A, we don't totally destroy a statue. Having it moved, yeah, that's reality. Because I think it's really a learning thing. One of our panelists mentioned that, too. We bring a lot of youngsters into the museum every year with our education department. And I just think it's a good teaching experience. If you could bring someone in and there is a statue that's been moved from somewhere to, say, the museum, and you can talk about the life of that person succinctly, obviously, looking at both the good and the bad part. And I just think they're important in that respect, too. But obviously, there are lightning rods now and have been for a good while for so much controversy. But there's been so many different approaches. And I still think we're kind of like in the early stages of what to do with these things. I was kind of pushed when I saw the statue of that slave trader in England. I think it was in Bristol that was thrown into the sea. I would have rather have had it preserved somewhere with, you know, the proper description of his life and what he represented, much of which would have been negative.
Yeah. Dr. Royals, I mean, again, because it's our history, whether we like it or not. And I always think about like how Germans have to deal with their history. Within the last century, it's there. You can't erase it, but how should we be approaching this?
So I've spent the most time thinking about what to do with Confederate monuments, and Civil War historians have proposed a kind of intervention here that I think would be useful for the conquistador statues as well. We can move these statues into museums where they can be much more appropriately contextualized. But I want to be clear on the point that these should not be displayed in public in the way that they are now. What we can do is to leave the pedestals in place, stripped of any celebration of Confederate leaders, of the Confederacy itself, and contextualize the empty place where the statue used to stand. I think that would be a really powerful testament to the way that we, I want to say that we have moved on as a country, but I don't think that's true. But I think it could be a really powerful testament to the kind of country that we want to be.
Yeah. Let me just jump in as we finish up here.
That we have this ugly past that we need to grapple with.
Right. I just wanted to get to one more thing real quick. We did hear, we're getting comments from people. We did hear from Sean Patrick Perez on Facebook shared a quote from the book 1984 by George Orwell, the one that says every statue and street building has been renamed, every date has been altered, and the process is continuing day by day and minute by minute. History has stopped. Very interesting quote to share. Dr. Quigley, what can we take away from this moment of historic reckoning?
Yeah, I want to respond to that caller because I think he represents that idea, represents something that other people are concerned about, right? And I think you alluded to it. We have this dark past, and so we're hiding it. And that's not what at all we're proposing, right? I want to be really clear. It's about the distinction between revering a particular individual and actually contextualizing them, right? So what is it that we're choosing to revere? This is not a 1984 scenario where we're reworking or rewriting, right, the past. We're actually trying to move towards a more just and accurate depiction of historical realities, right? And in order to kind of again approximate or approach that, there has to be more context. There has to be a kind of a more honest appraisal of the impact and the legacy that's being celebrated.
That is an interesting point. This is a fascinating debate. I have to end it on that because of time, but history is always such an interesting thing because, you know what? We think we have it figured out. We really haven't. That I used to be a history major. But anyway, I want to thank my guest, Dr. Andrea Quigley, Associate Professor at Florida International University of Anthropology, Dr. Dan Royals, Assistant Professor of United States and African American History, and Dr. Paul George, Resident Historian at History Miami Museum. Folks, thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Well, still to come, we're going to talk with a professor who teaches a course in happiness and try to figure out how to find happiness in these difficult times. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, you know, we are living in one of the most challenging times in modern history. I mean, we're dealing with a global pandemic, and it's killed more than 125,000 Americans. We are in the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, putting tens of millions of people out of work. And we're dealing with racial tension in America now at a crucial, critical turning point as protests continue against police brutality. But needless to say, it may be difficult to find moments of joy in all of this because there was a recent report from the University of Chicago titled Americans Are the Unhappiest They've Been in 50 Years. According to the report, only 14% of people in this country consider themselves to be happy. So how do we find happiness in all of this? Dr. Sandro Formica is an FIU professor of self-science. He's dedicated much of his research to the economics of happiness, and he joins us now via Skype. Dr. Formica, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hello, Luis. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So let me start with this. Do you consider yourself to be a happy person right now? I mean, again, considering the world the way it is, are you happy?
yes, I am. But I need to work on that, though. I was not born happy. I had to work a lot on that. And that's probably one of the main reasons why I can teach it.
You know, I was thinking, too, of those people who are happy, considering everything that's going on. Do you ever feel guilty for being happy when other people are struggling?
That's an interesting point. No, because if I feel guilty, I'm not helping others anyway. So my purpose is really to spread happiness through self-awareness around the world. And I can only do that if I do my part, if I get myself together. No, definitely not. I'm actually very proud to test my level of happiness, especially in moments such as this one.
Dr. Formica, how do you define happiness?
Okay, so happiness has three critical elements. And the first one is the joy that we experience, so the feeling. The second is the commitment. You know, the pursuit of happiness, it's so beautiful. You know, there are not many constitutions that include happiness. and America has one. So is one of the very few. So the commitment to happiness is very critical. And the third element is the meaning, we give to things, the meaning we give to life. So generally, people concentrate only on the first one. Is that fleeting moment, you know, the length can vary, but the point is, okay, the joy, can I hold on to it? Well, it's not only that. The commitment and the meaning are equally important to create sustainable happiness.
And I'm wondering, how do you define happiness, you know, from an economic standpoint?
Oh, there is not much of a difference. I mean, it's just behavioral happiness. So we know that Kahneman was a psychologist and got the Nobel Prize for economics and just working on this. So the point is, behaviorally speaking, when is that we feel good about ourselves and about the world?
Have people, again, considering the world we're living in right now, have people been forced to reevaluate the, you know, the different parts of their lives that bring them happiness? You know, especially since we're self-quarantined a lot of the time, we have to stay alone.
Okay. Let me give you my example then. I was in Italy till February 27th, I believe. And then I rushed back to the States because I was going to speak at the World Happiness Summit. Please remember that Miami is a very, very lucky place because it hosts the most important happiness event in the world, which is the World Happiness Summit. So I came back because I didn't know if they were going to quarantine or not. And so I went back, and interestingly enough, as soon as I arrived, soon after, the very same day, a very important relationship that was supposed to be ending with a marriage ended that very day. And I found myself not knowing where I was going to stay overnight. And I spent 4 months in an empty space where they were doing the work, the concrete restoration outside. So the drilling was going on all the time, and I couldn't access the terrace or you know, open the windows. So you see now, obviously there have been much more negative cases, but just to give you a perspective, what do you do with it? It's the most important thing. How do you perceive, what meaning do you give, and how committed are you to being happy? So I said, okay, this is a perfect occasion for me to test my happiness. And I cannot tell you how much, no, despite the challenge, there's no question it was a challenge for me too, but how much creative work I have done in those 4 months. Truly, I wouldn't have reached that level of creative work in years. So I made the best out of it, knowing that that could have been, you know, a positive consequence to that.
I'm talking with Dr. Sandro Formica, an FIU professor of self-science. He's been studying the economics of happiness. We're discussing how individuals are finding happiness, especially in this world. And you could see some of the research he's done on happiness. Go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Again, Doctor, you teach at FIU self-science and economics of happiness. What's the class like?
Okay, the class is very, very experiential. My point is that teaching only intellectually is not really helpful. Can you imagine that we studied, before entering college, we studied 20,000 hours of class time and study time from first grade to 12th grade. And when I ask students, how much do you remember of all that you studied? The most common answer is either 5 or 10%. And I ask them why, and they say, what do we do with it? No, I'm not saying that what we study in class is not important, but clearly we got to experience what we study. So class is a class where we start working on needs, and intellectually everybody understands what a need is, but when we start really keeping a diary of needs and saying, okay, what kind of needs I have today, and how many of them were met, at what percentage? Did I decide that this person was the right person to satisfy my needs or not? Because maybe they don't even know we actually appointed them as those who have to satisfy our needs. And if you don't know this, how can you be happy in the first place if your needs are not met?
That's an interesting point. Let me finish with this. You think about the world we live in today. I wonder how you approach somebody if they say to you, look, I just lost my job, or someone I loved had COVID, or, I mean, again, all the social unrest that we see. Where do you start the conversation with them about how they can find happiness in all of this?
Beautiful. Let me give you an example. Myself and my team gave away 400 hours of work one-on-one, and we had people of this type. Actually, many were coming from the medical world and they were dealing with the pandemic in the first place. So we asked them, you know, what do you feel? Where do you feel your feelings? Very, very often they're completely detached, disconnected from their body. And then we measure the intensity of that feeling. And from that, we started talking about the needs that were not met that generated the uncomfortable feeling. And after that, I asked them, I said, how can you satisfy those needs anyway? You know, what's, you know, I have a need for social life. I have a need for support. I have a need. And so we started working on finding ways to get those needs satisfied, even with the lockdown. And after that, we started talking about values, what's important in life, and life purpose. And this is what I can tell you, that from an intensity of a negative feeling, 1 to 10, of an average of 8, they changed to an average of 3.6. So there was a tremendous improvement just in 45 minutes.
Yeah, I got to stop you there. This is such a fascinating topic because something we need to discuss again in the time that we're living in. Dr. Sandro Formica, FIU professor of self-science. You can find more of his study on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Dr. Formica, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Pleasure speaking with you.
And again, happiness to you and to all of us. That's our program for this Monday, June 29th. Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, at the start of the pandemic, Governor Ron DeSantis imposed 14-day quarantine for travelers to Florida from New York. And now it's flipped. New Yorkers are now imposing travel restrictions on Floridians. We're going to talk about the differing responses between the two states. Plus, a conversation about restaurants and bars. Bars no longer can serve alcohol. Servers have to wear masks and customers have to keep that social distance. We're going to talk about those guidelines and if they're being enforced. All that coming up tomorrow on the program.